This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Haney. Later in the show, how Rothenburg Academy in Over the Rhine is helping children and their families fight the poverty that surrounds them. But first, finalized on November 21, 1995 at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the Dayton Peace Accords ended the war in Bosnia and Herzegovina. The war, which had lasted more than 3 years, cost 100,000 lives. It drove 2 million people from their homes. Current and former world leaders are participating in events this week to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the Dayton Peace Accords. And joining us for a look at that diplomatic success and the lasting effect it's had on the region are President and CEO of McCants Consulting Group and Dayton Peace Accords at 20 Committee Chair John McCants, and Janeta Begic from Bosnia, who's studying at the University of Dayton as a Dayton Peace Accords Fellow. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Janeta and John, thank you for joining me today.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
Thank you.
John, give us some background on this. What led to this war in the first place? It started in 1992, correct?
Well, the hostilities actually occurred before that. Where it really started to reach international attention, if you will, cross-border attentions, was in the 92 timeframe. And there were very unsuccessful efforts by regional leaders from neighboring countries and even the European community to try to quell the hostilities. But it just escalated to the point that In 95, the Croatian government exercised some fairly significant military plans, as did then the United States was drawn into it, basically based upon international pressure. So the United States and Russia, to a lesser degree, brought to the table the negotiators in Dayton and Wright-Patterson in November of 95.
You know, I've often heard the word genocide attached to this. Is that the case?
Yes. Your opening statement was absolutely correct. I mean, more than 100,000 people lost their lives. It was horrific. And that was part of the international outrage that really helped to pressure the international community to take a leadership role, and especially the United States, in ending the hostilities. It was so bad that in the country of Bosnia-Herzegovina that families of different ethnicities would trade family members and have them go into each other's homes and sleep there to protect themselves, protect the families from attack. Because now those houses were blended with different ethnicities. That's how horrific some of this was.
The end result is the Yugoslavia broke up.
Yes.
Because this was originally Yugoslavia.
Correct.
That we're talking about, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, you were talking about the U.S. involvement. It started during the last year of the George H.W. Bush administration, heading into the administration of Bill Clinton. And was there an impact from this transition in presidencies on the level of involvement in the war?
I think it was more the escalation had grown from an international perspective and with the United Nations involvement that it kind of, if you will, forced the hand of President Clinton and the Clinton administration to take a greater leadership role in helping to end the conflict.
Because if I understand correctly, prior to that, for some time, we had hoped that Europe itself would settle
right.
the issue.
Exactly. Right, exactly. And to your point, yeah, I mean, what you said in the beginning, and then that 92 to 90, 93, 94, 95 timeframe, that was trying to – not that we were in an isolation stage from a United States perspective, but the philosophy was at that time, to a certain degree, was the UN was going to take care – or I'm sorry, the Europeans were going to take care of their own house cleaning, if you will.
Janeta, what are things like in Bosnia these days?
These days, well, infrastructurally, it's great. Bosnia doesn't look like a war country, which is kind of something that's understandable. 20 years after the war, we have beautiful cities, beautiful infrastructure, everything is recovered, but politically it's not really great. We still have these ethnic tensions and very high levels of nationalism, which I think should be addressed more than it is now.
What kinds of things would you like to see happen? How would you like to see the whole issue addressed?
I'm not sure, but I think that international community can do more regarding the situation in Bosnia and Herzegovina. It's not just enough to send money, send donations. I think it's important to see where that money goes, what's been done with that money, because we are facing a lot of corruption in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And, for example, the media is very politicized. So we have these ethnic tensions that are actually fueled by the media, by the politics, and that is what divides people instead of uniting them. So I think that projects and activities should be done actually to unite people, unite different ethnic groups in Bosnia and Herzegovina, rather than dividing them, because we don't want 93, 94, 95 to happen again in Bosnia.
John, to Janetta's point, has this fallen off the radar? Is the world paying enough attention to this region?
No, I don't. You know, unfortunately, with the situation around the world, there's so many opportunities to focus attention on from an international perspective that it's difficult at times for any administration or any State Department to really stay focused. But one of the unique things about what we do in Dayton and with the anniversary events in particular, we started the year after in 96 having anniversary events. And for the first 5 years straight, we had policy discussions with each of our anniversary events. And those policy discussions were we invited leaders from Bosnia-Herzegovina, from the neighboring countries, from the European Union, from the U.S. State Department to participate. And for the first 5 years, we kind of – it was just status quo. One point that needs to be made about the document, the accord itself that was agreed upon at Wright-Patterson in 95, was that there was no expectation on the part of the State Department or even any of the Europeans that were involved and the Russians that were involved in helping to support the negotiations. That the document was going to be a permanent document, that was going to be the permanent structure for the country, because it formed a triumvirate form of government where you had the three ethnic parties, the three ethnicities all sharing leadership in the government. And in the initial stages, the turnover was almost every 6 months. And this goes all the way down. If you can imagine in our country, not only the president of our country, all the way down to the county commissioners changing leadership every 6 months, you know, as complex as our political system is, overlay on top of that the fact that this change was going on. Now, over time, those shifts in leadership has changed. But the reality is the document has stayed in place as agreed upon 20 years later, and there was never that intention. It was meant to be a temporary solution to end the hostilities with the hopes that it would provide a construct for self-governments and for their ability to create a viable and working constitution that would be more synergistic with all the ethnicities.
So, Janetta, did you want to say anything?
Oh, no. I just wanted to say, yeah, that I agree, and that right now there's constant talk about reforms of the Constitution and that actually followed Dayton Peace Agreement. But even at the first, it wasn't actually interpreted the same way from the same people. Everyone interprets it differently. And those people that are in position, they do not agree of what it means even.
And what we saw, you know, after those first 5 years, We just got to the point where, okay, kind of the community of Dayton got it. I mean, it was a regional event. I mean, SOCHE, the Southern Ohio Council of Higher Education, has been involved. So UC, Xavier, Miami, all the universities in the region had been involved in with either student participations or classroom activities, whatever the case may be. But we found after, okay, we're at a point. After 5 years of these policy discussions where nothing really new was being brought to the table, that they were pretty well entrenched in this triumvirate form of government. So then we moved out and waited 5 more years. So at the 10-year anniversary, we had another policy conference in conjunction with the anniversary. We've always had anniversary events, but the policy conference or portion of it only came back at year 10, then 15, and now 20. What we saw at year 10 was it was still pretty much status quo. The same political leaders were in charge that were really either part of the initial negotiators in 95 or lieutenants, if you will, of those individuals. And then in year 15, there was a new generation. And actually, I was a lot more hopeful at year 15 that with this new generation that we're more openly criticizing the Dayton Agreement and the construct, if you will, that we were going to see there was promise for change, that maybe there would be some movement towards this new constitution and then more of a synergistic form of government. But now, my co-chair, and let me get that up right front. I'm the co-chair of the committee because I co-chair with Dayton City Commissioner Matt Joseph, and not that he would be totally upset, but it's just, okay. It's just appropriate to say I'm co-chair of the overall committee. He and I have been working on this for 3 years, and Matt is married to a Bosnian, and he travels back and forth every year and has been very engaged in the discussions with not only our embassy but with the leaders in the country. And unfortunately, I think we're kind of going backwards a little bit to where that new generation I talked about at year 15 is now kind of more of the same status quo as the previous generation.
Janetta, is it fair to say that things are improving in Bosnia, just the pace is slow?
I really hope that's true. I really want to believe that things are improving, and I can see that younger generation, meaning young people in their 20s, are willing to work more than they used to work for actually standing up for themselves, being active in their communities, and doing different kinds of projects which would actually help our country move forward, and even different ethnic groups working together. So I'm very optimistic about that, and I hope that will continue. But other things, I mean, 20 years after the war, comparing to some other countries that had wars, and after 20 years, they are actually way ahead than Bosnia and Herzegovina. I think that things are going too slow right now, and especially because it's always the same same politicians, same people with same ideologies, which are not trying as hard as they should be, I think.
We will continue our conversation about the Dayton Peace Accords, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and my guest this afternoon, President and CEO of McCants Consulting Group and Dayton Peace Accords at 20 Committee Co-Chair, John McCants, and Janetta Bigich, who's studying at the University of Dayton as a Dayton Peace Accords Fellow. You can join the conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. John, why was Dayton picked as the site for negotiating the peace agreement?
Interesting story. There were about 5 locations that were looked at. Secretary Christopher in counsel with the president, and then identifying Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, the late Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, as the lead negotiator for the United States, wanted a location pretty much on a military installation where the negotiators could be brought and more or less confined, not in a, you know, Guantanamo type of environment, but in a setting where intense negotiations could occur without the distractions of what's outside the fence. Such as, you know, the typical spots would be New York or Washington, D.C. or something like that. But the problem is many more distractions than were desired. And also they were very interested in, and were focused on limiting media interchange between the negotiators and the media, because they wanted to control the not so much the message, but they wanted to keep the negotiations on message, on track, and not divert based upon what a negotiator X said to the media or negotiator Y. So they looked at military installations, and we were one of five. I was in the Air Force and actually part of the negotiating support team. There was a long list of Air Force personnel that supported this, both in uniform and civilians, to prepare Wright-Patterson to host the debates. And I was honored to be part of that. And I served as the liaison to the spokesman for the State Department, retired Undersecretary Nick Burns. So I was actually in the Hope Hotel for all 21 days of the negotiations. But the what came down to it is that Wright-Patterson's roughly an hour away from New York and Washington, D.C. The Hope Hotel on Wright-Patterson was capable of holding all the delegations, would have their own breakout rooms. Then there was a large ballroom / conference room, plus there was room for media. I mean, the building was perfect. And then directly across a short walk from that building were five individual what were at the time visiting officers' quarters that could be converted into delegation buildings for each of the principal delegations. So we really learned about it about the 13th or 14th of November. The current base commander at the time was Colonel, October. The current base commander at the time was Colonel Robbie Robinson, and he's on our committee, and he's actually been involved in these anniversaries.
Pretty short notice, it sounds like.
Yeah. October 13th, he found out. I was a public affairs officer at the time. I was called down to the installation. Public affairs officer told, hey, don't, you know, show up. Don't bring your cell phone. This is, you know, we're not talking about this. So I go down there, and I'm on the phone with the folks from the State Department, and it was publicly announced on October 18th that they were arriving on the end of October, so October 31st, and the negotiations would begin on November 1st. And the base had the people that worked the hardest, in my opinion, were the base civil engineers, because fences had to be put up, sidewalks had to be put in places. All of those five rooms had to be five buildings. Two rooms had to be converted into one-room suites. Identical furniture for all five of those rooms had to be purchased, because the State Department was very concerned that if Milosevic or Igabegovich went into each other's rooms, like that was going to happen, but in the case it would, everything had to be identical. So one principal negotiator could not say, well, you know, they have nicer furniture, or they have better pictures, or whatever. Everything was identical. All that had to be done, basically, from about the 16th of October until 31 October.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty. How many countries were involved in the negotiations?
Well, you had the three, the three principal countries were Bosnia, Croatia, and Serbia. Then you had the European Union, which was the fourth delegation, and then the American delegation. So the European Union was a complex, I mean, it was a composite, if you will, of a lot of different countries. England was involved. Russia was involved. There were a number of countries that were part of the European Union delegation. And then, of course, Bosnia, Serbia, and Croatia.
How long were the negotiating sessions? Did they run pretty much around the clock?
Well, you know, they worked in the hotel pretty much during the normal daylight hours, and then they would retire back to their individual sleeping rooms, or their buildings. And what and I was, this was like an immersion course in diplomacy for me because, you know, I wasn't in the room for 99.9% of the discussions, but I supported the guy that was going to come out and go talk to the media about what was happening. So I had, it was truly a life-changing experience for me. But I also know that a lot was done during the dinner hours and into the evening. You've heard the term shuttle diplomacy, where you know a group of diplomats would go from one country to another to help with negotiating something. It was more like parking lot diplomacy at Wright-Patterson because literally four of the five buildings were in a quad, and if Ambassador Holbrooke would see Milosevic out in the parking lot smoking a cigarette and needed to have a conversation or wanted to make a point, he could see out of his room that Milosevic was out there having a cigarette, and either he would go out or he would send somebody out there. There was always that engagement and interaction. So it was.
And Milosevic was the leader of Serbia at the time. Okay.
Yeah.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. How many people total did it take?
About 800.
800 people.
Yeah.
Wow.
The negotiating party, the negotiation body, if you will, was about 800 people.
Janetta, do you find that pretty amazing?
Yeah, I didn't know it was that much. I thought it was like 300-400.
It turns out to be about twice that many. Yes. Now, you mentioned Richard Holbrooke, Ambassador Holbrooke.
Sure.
Now, tomorrow there is going to be a dedication ceremony.
Right.
He's going to have a plaza dedicated in his name. Where is that at?
That's the city of Dayton, Salem Avenue Bridge in the city of Dayton, which is downtown Dayton, right off Interstate 75. Richard Holbrooke has become a son of Dayton, if you will. He was very gracious in always participating in our events. His widow will be at the ceremony. Kathy Barton will be part of the ceremony and she will be here through Saturday. His oldest son, David Holbrooke, will also be here. And David has produced and is currently on HBO a documentary on his father called The Diplomat. That will be screened on Thursday night at the National Museum of the United States Air Force. And actually, you can still register for that. That's Thursday night at 6 o'clock. And then Friday night, we're having a reception at the Dayton Art Institute where we're going to announce – it's already been publicly announced – but Angelina Jolie is the 2015 recipient of the Dayton Peace Prize. And we've only given a Peace Prize for five times. And because of her work internationally and especially in Bosnia, early on in her life, she realized the atrocities that occurred in Bosnia and actually joined forces at one point with Princess Diana to help with landmine eradication and things of that nature in Bosnia, but also around the world. So she's our 2015 recipient. Unfortunately, she's in Cambodia filming a Tomb Raider movie. So it's going to be just the unveiling of the Peace Prize and talking about her and the previous recipients. That's Friday night.
And Janetta, what part are you playing in the conference? You're part of a panel discussion, right?
Yeah, that's on Friday around 2, I think. We have a panel discussion, me and two other students that are here as Dayton Peace Accords Fellows. So we're going to talk about what's the situation nowadays.
Now, and President Bill Clinton is the keynote speaker, or former President Clinton's the keynote speaker. Is that
President Clinton will be at the University of Dayton Rivers campus, and University of Dayton has been a great partner along with Wright State and the Regional Transit Authority. We have so many sponsors. I don't want to miss one. So, but we could not have done this without the community support we have. But yes, President Clinton will be the lunch speaker on Thursday, the 19th. Unfortunately, that's well sold out. And we hope to have, there will be media coverage, of course, and there is the potential for some streaming of that. And then the last event is actually on Saturday, the 21st, which is the 20th anniversary to the day. And we're moving our events to the Hope Hotel where the document was initialed and having our closing brunch and keynote speakers there. And that event is still open to the public.
Well, what do you think was the key lesson to be learned from these peace accords? What makes them relevant 20 years later?
Well, it became a model. It actually, it's referred to in the diplomatic community as the Dayton model. And that's this intense kind of boot camp negotiation environment, if you will, where the negotiators are brought together with minimum distraction to try to accomplish a goal. So it has become a model. And I think that's a lasting legacy that will always be part of Richard Holbrooke.
Well, Janetta and John, thank you for talking with me this afternoon. President and CEO of McCants Consulting Group and Dayton Peace Accords at 20 Committee Co-Chair John McCants and Janetta Begich from Bosnia, who's studying at the University of Dayton as a Dayton Peace Accords Fellow. Coming up, childhood poverty and over the Rhine and how a local school is helping kids and families rise above it. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.